Welcome to the Cowboy Chronicles. I am Scott Wright. This is your Oklahoma State football and basketball podcast from NewsOK.com. Finally joined. It's been a while. It's been a while since we've done a podcast. That's because I've been solo and I didn't want to make anybody have to listen to me talk for half an hour. Nathan Ruiz, my new beat partner on the Oklahoma State beat, is here. Nathan, thank you for finally joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Scott. I know I can make things a little easier on you, so it's good to be able to do that and also, you know, kind of hit the ground running.
It's you absolutely did, and we'll get into that here shortly. But Nathan, first of all, some people who follow Oklahoma State might be a little bit familiar with you being an Oklahoma State graduate. So kind of tell the listeners and the followers out there a little bit about you. You're originally from Reno?
Yeah, so I'm originally from Reno, Nevada. Wanted to do sports journalism in college, and so Oklahoma State seemed like a great option. Didn't really know much about it at the time. Did a Google search, took a couple visits, and that's where I ended up going to school. So I did that and worked for the Ocali for 4 years. So I covered OSU football, OSU basketball, and OSU baseball for most of my college tenure. Along the way, had internships at my hometown paper, the Reno Gazette Journal. Had an internship here at the Oklahoman after my sophomore year. Was at the Dallas Morning News, and then after graduating, I was with MOE.com covering the San Diego Padres. Worked my way here, fortunately. So after graduating in May, just a few months later, I'm right back in Oklahoma. Moved all my stuff back to Nevada, and then I had to drive it all back here. But I'm here now, and I'm excited. Definitely was a great situation to jump into. I think a situation I'm familiar with, working with people who I've worked with before. And so, yeah, it's just really exciting for me.
Now, as you mentioned, I'm really excited for you to be here after a good month and a half of flying solo on all this and a basketball team that's better than we expected to be and getting a chance to cover them and obviously following the end of football season and all of that. But through the fall, I want to talk about your MLB internship because yeah. I'm a little bit of a baseball junkie. That's my hobby. But what was that like getting to be around a baseball team and cover them the way that you did?
Yeah, it was definitely a really cool experience just to be there every day. And that's the thing is, you know, having covered college football here at Oklahoma State, you know, you have a Monday availability and then it's Saturday's game. With baseball, you're there every day. You know, you're there 4 hours before first pitch. You got pregame interviews. You watch the game. You got postgame interviews. So it's just such an involved process. And I think it really helped me grow as a journalist and as a reporter, doing all those things every day and having such, even though it was so structured, there was so much freedom in what you could do. So it was definitely cool. And in the same way, I'm a huge baseball junkie. That was like to get that MLB.com internship is just really exciting for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I did that. I was in San Diego, which was great. No complaints about living in the city of San Diego. So the Padres, you know, they were a much more competitive team at home than they were on the road. And so I was mostly at home games. So the team I saw wasn't awful. But yeah, I think that organization is one on the rise. And then I was fortunate enough to get the opportunity to actually go cover some postseason baseball. I had family out in D.C., so I moved out there and covered the NLDS between the Nats and the Cubs, which to go from like Petco Park in August to Nats Park in October, totally different thing.
Yeah.
The atmosphere is crazy, but it was just such a cool experience to lump that 4 to 5 month window together and get to think of all the different things I went through from start to finish. It was just a really valuable experience for me.
Now, did you go to any of the games at Wrigley in that series?
No, I did not. I was just based in D.C. I'd seen Wrigley before, never actually been to a game, but like obviously that's a goal at some point. I want to beat all 30 at some point.
Right.
But yeah, it was definitely, I mean, I did go to new parks. I'd not been to either of the parks in L.A. before, so I drove up, saw a game in Anaheim, covered a Dodgers-Padres series in L.A. So yeah, that was cool, and I'd seen Nats Park before, but again, I hadn't been to a game before my internship. I'd been to Petco a time or two, but to go to all those different parks and get that experience and just, I mean, watch, I don't know, 60-something baseball games for a summer, like, I can't think of too many things better than that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not out of the ordinary for us to break into some baseball chat on this podcast.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
John Helsley was a huge Cardinals fan. I'm a huge Cubs fan. He didn't want to talk as much as I did in the last part of the season. But anyway, we'll move on because, like you mentioned, you hit the ground running. Your first game out of the gate is Bedlam, packed house. Talk about what the atmosphere was like because I was covering the women's Bedlam game in Norman, and it really had a feeling like there were some empty seats because of what was going on in Stillwater that day.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I think the timing of that game from OSU's perspective was great. The students were back. School started up again, so everyone was in town that way. But just, you know, every big shot, that place erupted. You know, I always hear about the glory days. I'm 22 years old, so I don't know what GAA was like back when there were only two levels. But I know that place, when it gets loud and it gets full, whether it's an OU game or a Kansas game, that seems to be really the only teams that place gets full for anymore. But it's one of the top arenas in the country, I think, when you have that kind of atmosphere in play. And that's why OSU has been able to beat OU the past couple of years, why it's been able to have that string where they beat KU and storm the court 3 years in a row. So I think there's something about that arena when it's full that it's still just as magical of a place.
You mentioned storming the court. Yeah. We talked about this. Ryan Aber apparently got hit on the head at some point during not during the court storming, just an angry fan that accidentally clocked him in the head, apparently. But as I was watching the game from sitting in the Lloyd Noble Center press room, and I see the fans storming onto the court, knowing where press row is there on that baseline, I was really worried that there were some students that were trying to make the jump over that table and take some people out.
Well, I know that's what's happened before. It preemptively, me and then Mark Cooper and Cody Staven of the Tulsa World, we all put our laptops away and we're just like ready for what was happening next. But all of them were actually very respectful because they all went around us. They just like parted to the right and left.
Yeah.
I think what happened is that front row decided that's what they were going to do and everyone else kind of just followed suit. Mm-hmm. So we were really lucky. I was a student my freshman year. I stormed the court and for one of the KU games. And it's like you just all like band arms and you just are kind of all in it together. So I know what it's like to go through that. And so there's such an energy to it. You could just go straight forward and trip and fall and whatever. So as a media member, I was very fortunate that everyone just kind of went the other way.
Yeah. Now that you've had a few days to sort of look back on that game, what sort of stands out to you as kind of a turning point or one storyline of that game that flipped it for Oklahoma State?
Well, I mean, I think the shot from Kendall Smith really stands out, the three-pointer at the end to tie it. But I think it really gets back to Mitchell Solomon's hustle play. And did he foul? Did he travel? Whatever. Mm-hmm. You take note of the fact that he, as a big man, stole the ball from the National Player of the Year frontrunner, Trae Young, dove on the floor, passed the ball, and it set them up. They were down five at the time, so that sets them up. Gets within three, and then Kendall Smith hits the shot. If Mitchell Solomon doesn't make that play, maybe Trae Young comes down the floor, hits a three, and the game's over.
Yeah.
OSU loses in regulation. So, I mean, Mike Boynton said it all season. Mitchell Solomon is the MVP of that team.
Yeah.
And it's because he does things that aren't necessarily going to show up in that box score. You're going to look back at the end of the day, and you're going to look and see Mitchell Solomon dove on the court. Like, it's not going to say that there.
Right.
But if you watch the game, you see the impact he has. I mean, you go back to the charge taken against Florida State after having the go-ahead tip-in. Yeah. So, I mean, he's a guy who's been having this huge impact all season long. And it's really been building for 4 years. He's a senior now. And you watched how, I guess, uncomfortable he really was as a freshman. He just was timid, unwilling to shoot the ball, and now he's just playing with so much more confidence. I think that naturally happens as you grow into the game and grow into the university. But he's a guy who's OSU through and through, who always wanted to be here, and now he's in his fourth year. This is his last ride, and he's trying to make the most of it.
Yeah, and really, you look at some of the games that, they had a couple of home games that were closer than people thought they were going to be with Iowa State and Texas. They had that loss at Kansas State. I think he fouled out of all three of those games. Definitely the two home games I know that he did, and there was something missing when he was not on the floor. Whether he was in foul trouble or after he had fouled out, there was something missing. And I mean, what he brings is so hard to tangibly quantify, but it's definitely there, and it's really fascinating to watch. So looking forward now to what this team's got coming up. Obviously, we're recording this on Tuesday early afternoon. They're at Lubbock tonight. Just really quickly, any top line thoughts on that game and what that might be like, what they might need to do to try to pull one out there?
Well, I think they're getting Texas Tech at a good time. Texas Tech coming off a low week, which could mean that, I mean, they're both road games they played. They haven't lost at home yet, but they just lost two games on the road to Texas and Iowa State. But it's a really experienced team. They were a top 10 team a week ago. Now they're number 18. But OSU is a team that needs a road win. They haven't won a road – heading into this podcast, they haven't won a road game.
Right.
And so Mike Boyne, I talked to him yesterday. He made a big point, like, we need to have a sense of urgency about this. We need to be able to play a full 40 minutes because they haven't done that yet on the road. They have had these stretches where they've looked like a really good team, but then there's a 4 or 5 minute stretch where everything falls apart and that dooms them for the whole rest of the game. So it's something where they need to avoid that stretch or shorten it. If it's 1 to 2 minutes, it's something a little more easier for them to overcome. But if they're in a situation where it's 4 to 5 minutes again and they're not playing, as Mike Boyne said, that full 40 minutes, they're going to be it's going to be a problem because they're playing a very good Texas Tech team.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about that stretch, the moment that really comes back, that it goes back to for me, was thinking about the first Bedlam game. They came out of the gate in the second half and they had that 4 minute stretch where they couldn't do anything right. It was an 8-point game at halftime. Before they knew it, they were down 20. And they really, outside of that 4 minute stretch, played Oklahoma really well in that in the other 36 minutes of that game. But at the end of the day, it's a 20 point loss, and you know, 109 points given up. And so, yeah, those stretches have been crucial for them. You can look back at Kansas State at when they were down there or up there, and see the same issues that arose. So, be very interesting to see you know what they're able to do and how they're able to avoid those stretches. Looking forward, and obviously I know you're just really getting to sink your teeth into this team. Do you think this could be an NCAA tournament team at the end of the year?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they could be, and again, they could be.
Yeah.
And because anything could happen, but there's so many games left. They've got beyond their 11 conference games remaining. They still have a game at Arkansas on Saturday. So those 12 games are going to mean a lot to this team. It's a good team that even if it does play well, I think it'll still be classified as a bubble team, going to be in that 6-7-8 range in the Big 12. And so 6 is definitely, I think, would get them in. If they finish 6 in the Big 12, maybe get a win in the tournament, they'll definitely be in. But if they end up in that 7-8 range, it's going to be a little more questionable. So I think like an 8-10 finish in Big 12 play, getting a couple big road wins would help. I'm not saying you have to go to Allen Fieldhouse and win, but if you're able to go on the road to TCU and get a win there. If you're able to, you know, have Kansas at home and get a win there. I think to get to 8-10, they're going to need to beat some of these powerhouse Big 12 teams, whether it's a TCU or a Kansas or a West Virginia. And so they have those opportunities in front of them. So if they're able to end up in that 8-10, 9-9 range, I think they'll be in. The question is, I think they could do that, but the question is, can they? Will they? Yeah. You know?
Right. Obviously, you're just getting to know Coach Mike Boynton. I've been thoroughly impressed with him from I met him the very first time. It was actually at an event that I was at for football purposes, but he was there speaking at one of the Cowboy Caravan events in Oklahoma City back in July or August, and I got to meet him and visit with him off to the side before that event, and I saw him the next day. He came out to OSU football practice and remembered me, which I didn't expect, you know, because I'm sure he shook a million hands the night before at the Cowboy Caravan. So, but he called me by name and we talked, and I've been impressed with him ever since that moment. Getting to see how candid he is in his interviews, especially post game, has been fascinating and really fun to watch. But what are your first thoughts of getting to know Coach Boynton?
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. He's candid. He's genuine. He's kind of just like a dude. He's just like a regular everyday guy who you could like sit at the bar and have a conversation with.
Yeah.
And I think that's helped him so much work his way into this community, because I think so much of Stillwater is not only having success, what your team does on the court, but it's also how genuine you are, how easily is this community able to connect with you. And I'm sure that applies to a lot of universities, but especially in Stillwater, where it's such a little tucked away place, you know, 20 to 30 minutes away from any other metro area, or not necessarily metro, but any other town. So I think Stillwater is really unique in the way that it really embraces or doesn't embrace new people. You see, Travis Ford was there forever, third winningest coach in history, but it just never felt like he really synced in with the community. Mm-hmm. Mike Boynton, he's been here for a few months, and he seems like he's already right there in the middle of things. After the Bedlam game, he takes the mic, addresses the crowd, thanks them, promises, if you guys keep coming like this, we'll keep playing like this. So you know, he's a guy who very quickly has been able to work his way into this community. And I talked to Larry Reese about this last year. He had said that, like, it's a really easy community to get into if you're willing to let yourself into mm-hmm. it. And so I think that Mike Boynton has done a really good job. And I think it helped him a lot. I asked him about this yesterday too. It helped him a lot to have that year last year where he was just an assistant on Brad Underwood's staff, kind of just sat back and got to have an understanding of this is how Oklahoma State works. This is how Stillwater works. This is how this community is. And now he's there in the limelight now, able to kind of just have that year of understanding under his belt before he really took over.
Yeah, it's interesting because you think about like say he was at a place like TCU where you're in a big metropolitan area. You find some suburban community that you want to live in and you can kind of tuck yourself away and be off on your own and you send your kids to this school. You're in Stillwater and your kids are going to school with everybody's kids. And he's sending his son up to the same kindergarten that Joe Blow sitting in section 301 is sending mm-hmm. his kids to. So it's a very different dynamic, and I think you're absolutely right that he has blended very well into that situation. The Texas game, Eddie Sutton was there, and obviously it's a big deal anytime that Eddie is there. But there were some other guys like Joey Graham was there from one of the past Final Four teams, and Byron Eaton and Jamal Brown had come by and talked to the team, and a guy being so willing to not only accept those guys into the program and let them be around the program, but to sort of celebrate. He made a big deal about the fact that those guys had been there, in talking to the media, and he pointed out that they'd come and talked to the team and some things that they had said to the team, and celebrating the fact that these guys that had been connected to Oklahoma State were still sort of under the umbrella of Oklahoma State basketball, I think has really helped him, and I think it's probably helping. He talked about the fact that those guys were talking about the hard work that Coach Sutton's both Eddie and Sean had instilled in them when they were playing there and when they were having success there. And how he's trying to get those same lessons taught to these players. And he made the analogy that, it's like being a parent. You tell your kid the same thing 20 times, and then somebody else tells it to them, and it opens their eyes. You know, they're like, oh, okay, I get it now. And so, coming from a different perspective, it has a different impact on a team. So, he has, I think, really appreciated them being willing to come around. Because, let's be honest, this was not a popular hire among everybody, alumni included, mm-hmm. whenever it was made. And so to have the impact and the willingness of those guys to come around and be a part of things, I think is a pretty big deal for this team.
Yeah, especially when you consider that, he said it after the game. He was sitting there in the media conference and he's like, 12 months ago, I don't know if three people in this room knew who I was. And I'll be honest, when he got hired, I was like, Mike Boynton? And I was like, oh, he's an assistant? Okay. It didn't make much sense at the time, especially because of the other names being thrown around.
Right.
You have Doug Gottlieb, who's in the conversation, who's a national radio guy, an OSU guy. But that's the thing is about OSU is that you have to be an OSU guy to be at OSU. Mm-hmm. Not, I don't mean that in the sense of you have to be an alum, but you have to have an understanding of remember the 10, remember the 4, homecoming, all these different the Eddie Sutton, Henry Iba, all these different traditions and histories. You have to be able to immerse yourself in that. And it seems like Mike Boynton has done a very good job of that thus far.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll finish this up with a little bit of football talk. Obviously, you were chasing baseball teams around, but kept up a little bit. With the Cowboys, big time coming up for guys like Mason Rudolph, Marcel Aitman, James Washington, NFL draft preparations and evaluations are going on right now. Trey Flowers, Zach Crabtree, and Brad Lundblade were all in the East-West Shrine Game over the weekend. I recorded the game and sort of watched it quickly, sort of fast forward through just to watch some plays, and it there was a lot of buzz about Brad Lundblade, which was good to hear because he's such a great guy. Of all the things that I regret the most about my timing of coming onto this beat, it's that I didn't get to know some of these guys better, and he would be at the top of the list because he's a fascinating guy to talk to. He's so smart and so well spoken, and obviously to come from being a walk-on to doing what he did as a really a 4-year starter basically at center was pretty impressive. Love to see that guy get a chance at the next level. You know, when he came out of high school, you know, he was too small and too slow, and they're probably going to say the same thing about him at the next level. But to see him get some buzz, you know, get people talking about how you know, how intelligent he was at preparing the offensive line, getting them in the right situations and things at the Shrine game was good. Zach Crabtree looked really good at right tackle. Gave up a sack early, but came back and played really well, and was going against a really good defensive end when he gave up that sack. Trey Flowers was solid, though he didn't get a ton of action. So he's a guy that I think after the big three of Rudolph, Washington, and Aitman, I think Trey is the next guy in line that's got a chance to be drafted. The guy that's not getting talked about a whole lot right now, didn't get invited to any of these games, is DeQuinton Osborne, the defensive tackle. Only 6 feet tall, so I think that'll maybe cause him to drop down a little bit. But I think he's going to be in the mix for a draft spot. But let's focus though on the big three. Mason Rudolph, obviously a foot injury, not going to be playing this weekend in the game. But he did go out there to do the interviews and go through all the other things that they do that the scouts do in preparation for this game. Now you wrote the blog post earlier this week about his appearance on the Jim Rome show and his I guess proclamation maybe that he feels like he's the best that he's the best quarterback in this draft.
Yeah, I mean, speak what you want into existence, I guess.
Right?
I mean, I don't know that he necessarily isn't, to be honest. I mean,
right.
I think that when you look at that top group of Rosen, Allen, Darnold, Mayfield, Jackson, like Rudolph is right there, honestly, yeah. in my opinion. I don't think he's necessarily as flashy as those guys, and it helps that two of them are playing in L.A. and one of them is the Heisman Trophy winner.
Right.
But he was always just very calm. Like when I heard he said that, I was very taken aback, honestly, because it just doesn't seem like him.
Right.
But I get that you have to go out there and you have to advertise yourself. I mean, yeah. OSU built this huge Heisman campaign around him. He ends up finishing, I think, 7th
right.
in voting. But I mean, he went out there, had a really strong 4-year career, like greatest, by some standards, greatest quarterback in Oklahoma State history.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, you look at it. He's a guy who will end up being in the top two rounds, I would imagine, assuming there's a team that has a need and recognizes
right.
his ability to fit it. Is he going to end up being the number one pick or the number one quarterback taken? No. It's just not going to happen unless he goes out there in the combine and just absolutely blows people away.
Right.
I think there's already such a perception in place about Darnold and Rosen and seeing what Mayfield can do
mm-hmm.
that I think it'll be hard for – it'll just be so hard for Mayfield to leapfrog 4 to 5 guys.
Yeah.
But I think he's a guy that any team that gets him will be very happy. He's a young guy who I think will be ready to learn. You see the situation he stepped into in 2014 at OSU,
mm-hmm.
goes out there and is competitive against Baylor and then wins a game at OU as a true freshman. So he just kind of continued having success. Couldn't beat OU again, but, I mean, he did have a very strong – 4-year career and I think he's set up even without getting to play in the Senior Bowl. Like, he'll impress people with his personality, his mm-hmm. intelligence, his understanding of the game, and I'll set up really well come April.
Yeah, you know, and every time I say this, I feel like people think I'm taking a veiled shot at Baker Mayfield, but I'm not. But Mason Rudolph is not a guy that's going to be getting your team in the headlines on a Friday night doing something crazy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a good character kid. And like I said, that's not supposed to be some, you know, hidden, you know, I'm not subtweeting at Baker Mayfield.
Yeah, I think Mason is just more of like a B personality, I guess. He's obviously like a leader on the team, but
right.
he's just very relaxed. His demeanor is a lot more even-keeled, I think, when it comes to off the field stuff.
Exactly. Exactly, and you know, he understands kind of the right way to be, and you know, he understood really well the cowboy culture
mm-hmm.
that Mike Gundy preaches and works so hard to instill in that program. And so, you know, I think those things are going to benefit him really well when he's meeting with scouts and meeting with general managers and coaches. You know, and then when he gets in the film room, I think that he's really going to excel in what he shows coaches in his understanding of the game, his understanding of defenses. People don't realize how many defensive looks he saw this year, and not only that, how many of them that he had never seen before until he stepped out on the field on Saturday. So many different things that defensive coordinators were trying to do to take away the pass, especially the deep ball, which was obviously his bread and butter with James Washington. And they did so many unexpected things to him and that offense that I think that his understanding of those types of concepts is really going to benefit him. And you look at physically, he's got the body, he's got the arm, he can make that 12 yard out from the far hash that NFL teams love to see. So and obviously he's incredibly accurate on the deep ball, which we saw several times over and over again. Which brings me to James Washington. Mm-hmm. I don't know that there was anything more fun this year than just watching him run past people. That was probably my most fun thing of the season, just from a coverage standpoint, because it was so uniquely special to him, the way that he could keep going after not slowing down when he's looking back for the ball, which is, so many guys can't do, and things like that. Receiver is always a hard position to gauge where a guy might land in the draft. Not a lot of teams want to take a receiver really high because there are so many, but definitely first round talent, I think, in my opinion. Would you agree?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think his height might be a bit of a detriment to him in the long run, but I mean, he's been doing that since his freshman year.
Yeah.
Out there in the Cactus Bowl making jumping catches and all these different things.
Yeah.
So I think for him, it's just, work hard, do what you did for 14 years. I mean, he's from a 2A school in Texas, or 1A school in Texas. He was a 2-star player. No one expected him to become what he is today, Biletnikoff Award winner. So I think for him, it's just keep doing what you're doing. And wherever he goes, if he ends up going in the third round for some reason, he'll go off, and I think he'll have a successful NFL career because he's a hard worker and he's athletically gifted, and that's what he's done since the offset. He goes back to Stanford and talks to kids there. Mm-hmm. So I mean, he just still has a connection to where he's from, while still being able to look forward and move forward.
Yeah. I think a lot of the same things, though physically he's very different, can be said about Marcel Ayton.
Yeah.
Another just really solid guy. Obviously he's got his son Jaden now, and he's really motivated to go out and perform and be able to provide for him through playing in the NFL. I've said this multiple times on this podcast, on videos, in the paper. Nobody has come close to improving their NFL stock more than Marcel Ayton from August to now. And another big week for him to go really get in front of some NFL scouts and show what he can do at the Senior Bowl, don't you think?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think he's a guy who came into the year kind of as an unknown, coming off that foot injury. But you mentioned his son, that year off did him a lot of good. He could be home and kind of just gain a bit of perspective on these different things that maybe mean a little more than football. And so now he has, but at the same time, it helped him build an appreciation for the sport more, being away from it. So he's able to go out there and just show off that physical build. He's on a different team. If he doesn't have James Washington on his team, he could be up there in the Biletnikoff conversation by the end, could have been up there. So for him, it's just a matter of keep doing what you've been doing. And just, he went out there and they became the first duo. They had Mason Rudolph, the 4,000-yard receiver. Then you got the 1,000-yard Justice Hill, and then both of them putting up 1,000-yard seasons. So, I mean, that offense, you could talk about the system, and that gets back to Rudolph as well. Mm-hmm. But for him to have the number one receiver on his team and then have a 1,000-yard season, I think that just blows people away. And I think when you look at the physical size, he's exactly what you're looking for in an NFL receiver. He's the mold.
Yeah.
Whereas James Washington isn't necessarily. Mm-hmm. Marcel Ayton is exactly what teams look for when they say, I want a big receiver that's in the corner and we're going to hit him and we're going to get a touchdown. That's what he does, and that's what he proved to do this season.
Yeah. He knows how to use his body so well to go up and make plays, and he's strong. I think back to it wasn't a touchdown catch, but there was a third down play at Texas Tech where he went up and the receiver was in front of him. He went over the top of the defensive back was in front of him. He went over the top of the defensive back. The defensive back gets his hand on the ball and can't rip it out. He pulled it down, got a first down. They go down and score the clinching touchdown. So, obviously the Iowa State play, the touchdown there was such a big play that. It's funny because that's the play you remember from that game. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the game-winning touchdown. Dylan Stoner had that, and that sort of drifted off into oblivion. But that play of Rudolph rolling out and throwing to Aitman in double coverage and him going up and taking that ball out of the air is the scoring play, at least, that everybody remembers that. And then the interception at the end, of course. But mm-hmm. I've been a big fan. Marcel Aitman is another guy that would be high on my list of guys I wish I had gotten to know better, mm-hmm. Because talking to him is fascinating. And you mentioned, how grounded he is, that he has become, and seems like a very, very intelligent, but a very fun guy at the same time. James Washington is the same way. I as long as you're not talking to James Washington about James Washington, he is a fascinating guy. You talk to him about his teammates. You talk to him about hunting. You're gonna get entertaining stuff, interesting stuff out of him. Gundy liked to joke that he's so quiet, and he does have a quiet personality. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't talk on the field a lot. He's not a big trash talker. But the idea that that he didn't like talking to the media was not accurate at all. Mm-hmm. The problem was, every time the media got in front of him, they wanted to talk to him about him. And that was not what he was comfortable talking about.
I mean, honestly, like Mason Rudolph, that's another thing that surprised me so much, is he was very much the same way. So when he goes up there and makes that comment, "I'm the best in the draft," or like, it's like, whoa there, this is not. But I got to advertise yourself, got to put yourself in that position, because there's a politics to it.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just politicking. He's taking advantage of the medium that was placed in front of him.
Yeah, exactly. All right, just for fun, I didn't prepare you for this, but just for fun, out of those three guys, who gets picked first in the draft?
Oh, Mason, I think. Yeah. I think Washington is the better talent, mm-hmm. between the two of them, just NFL-wise. But I think just when you look at a quarterback is so important to an mm-hmm. NFL team. I think some team will recognize, like, hey, we could build around this guy. Maybe not throw him out there as a rookie, but if we give him 2 to 3 years, he's a guy we can put out there and be very comfortable with under center. So I think that he goes first. I think Aitman could surprise people and maybe jump not necessarily ahead of Washington, but be right there with him.
Right there, and maybe both be in be in the talks of late first round or second round. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very, very much a possibility. I like the scenario that you described for Rudolph. I think that would be perfect for him, mm-hmm. if he doesn't have to come in and be the guy right away and has a year or two to learn a system. I think that he could really excel. Because then you're talking about probably an established team at that point, rather than a team that's we got to build a team. Let's start with a quarterback.
I mean, you look at like all the different Cleveland quarterback things. Right. Like that's because they just keep having to throw guys in there who aren't ready for it. But you look at what Aaron Rodgers was able to do sitting behind Brett Favre. I mean, even Tony Romo had a decent NFL career, and he was a backup for his first couple of years. So I think if players are able to have that opportunity where they don't necessarily get thrust out there. I mean, you look at what Jimmy Garoppolo was even able to do once he got traded and started playing for the Niners, just had a lot of success after sitting behind Tom Brady.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would benefit any of those six guys I mentioned earlier.
Right.
Like to be able to go into a system where they aren't necessarily depended on to go out right away. Because honestly, I don't think, like, you wouldn't look at any of those guys. Like maybe we looked at Andrew Luck and Robert Griffin a few years ago. You don't look at him and say, I can put them in my offense right away and they're going to carry us they're going to make us a playoff contender right away, where Griffin and Luck both did that. Obviously, some injuries and various things have changed that picture for the two of them. But yeah, I think Rudolph is a guy who definitely, if you get some seasoning, gets his feet under him, he could have a lot of NFL success.
All right, good stuff, Nathan. Appreciate you coming on. We'll keep doing this on a more regular basis now that there's two of us. It's a lot more entertaining that way. He is Nathan Ruiz, my new beat partner on the Oklahoma State Beat. I am Scott Wright of The Oklahoman. Thanks to Greg for taking care of us and helping us get this all set up to go today. And thank you for listening. This has been the Cowboy Chronicles on News OK.